So five. So you're in good shape. Yeah. I feel terrible.
You do feel terrible.
Okay. Melted the wall, melted the black. Okay. Okay, everyone. It's so good to see everybody. Welcome. It's going to be Pesach soon. Everyone's very excited. We have some Divrei Torah for you tonight. I'm going to share some Divrei Torah, and then you're going to have the great schus of having Rabbi Fink share some Divrei Torah. Rabbi Fink and I have all the same Rabbeim, just 20 years apart, so don't worry. It's all in the same Mesorah, and we'll all sound, you know, similar. There'll be plenty of suffering to go around and plenty of existential tension and, you know, telling your Jewish story and all the metaphors from YU. Okay, so it's great to see everyone. I hope Pesach prep is going well. I'm thrilled to see the Chevra here. Let's talk about the Seder. So Seder night, as we know, the goal of Seder night is to be able to relive the story of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. Chayev Adam Liros Es Atzmo Ki'ilu Hu Yatzam Mitzrayim. So part of what happens on Seder night is a shift in mindset, is a shift in internal experience in terms of trying to relate to an actual journey of redemption. And the way we relate to a journey of redemption is marchu b'gnus u'mesayim b'shvach. We transverse the entire experience of this journey so that we are able to go ahead and capture not only the challenge and the suffering and the consternation that we experienced at the moments of Shibud, but also the relief and the sense of redemption that we experience at the moment of Geula. And that's the purpose of the night. So I just want to share some ideas. The goal of our Haggadah Shiurim, as always, is not to provide a large theme for Pesach. That will do Be'ezus Hashem in a few days from now, this Shabbos, twice. And we're all very excited about that. And so that's the goal of, that's what we do on Shabbos Haggadah. We do that through some of the Shiurim over Pesach. The goal of tonight is to give everyone something to share at the Seder, something to share at the Seder. So before I begin, I just want to make one comment about sharing things at the Seder. And that is that the momentum and the rhythm of the Seder should be accelerated and expanded through sharing Divrei Torah, not stifled and constrained. The greater degree to which the conversation could evolve naturally and with reality is actually a deeper fulfillment of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. Sometimes we get so stuck on our Divrei Torah. You know, this one has the briskerov they want to share. This one, might believe me, as I was running out of the house, my kids were like, you're going to tell them about the frogs, right? Like, everybody's got, you know, their thing that they say every single year. But sometimes we become so focused on the substance of the Divrei Torah. We buy a new Haggadah, and we want to share one of the 15 Rav Kanievsky Haggadahs. We want to share, you know, something for Rabbi Jonathan Sachs for 25 minutes. We want to share, like, we all have different ideas that we want to share. The greatest kiyum of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim is for this story to emerge naturally and for the conversation to emerge naturally. So I want to encourage everyone to also think about the use of questions, not just questions as they are scripted in the Haggadah, but questions that people raise at the Seder, not to, if someone raises a natural question at the Seder, to be a teacher. That's one of the things that the Seder night is amazing. I got, I actually got a Dr. Singer to look up from her knitting with that line, right? There are other things I could say that get Dr. Singer to look up, but it's not for tonight. So on Seder night, there are two things that we all become. We all become children because we're all supposed to be curious and thoughtful and inquisitive. And we also all become teachers. And the best teachers are not the teachers that walk in with the curriculum and just read off the information, right? The survey Jewish histories that we used to have at YU, where they just literally read the pieces of paper, and then you got the test from the previous generation, right? The best teachers are the ones that could evoke conversation, that could pull the information and the experience out of the students. So the more open-ended we can be, and the more responsive and thoughtful and reflective and interactive we could be, no one should feel, and this is my main point, no one should feel that that is a compromise to the substance of the Seder experience. The Seder, your metric of success, should not be the number of brisker divrei Torah you're able to get across. Your metric of success is there engagement and thoughtfulness and interaction and where appropriate and where possible, intergenerational dialogue. That's really what we're trying to accomplish. So I want to share a few beautiful ideas that you could share at your Seder. And the ideas that I'm sharing are things that could stimulate conversation. And then Rabbi Fink will share really profound, beautiful ideas. Halach ma'anya. So one of the things we do at the beginning of the Seder is we invite Halach ma'anya d'achal avasana ba'ar d'mitzrayim, and we say in the Haggadah that anyone that wants to come join our experience of the Seder, actually the technical translation is not only the Seder itself, but the Karban Pesach that we're relating to. Anybody that wants to come join the part of the Seder is welcome to join. In the Haggadah Tzof Amarim, I saw this year for the first time, he says the following. Yesh lefaresh achar she'anachnu ata begolus, mahar v'chaseinu b'yitzias Mitzrayim v'anachnu begola. So he says, you know, and I think this is a great point of discussion for the Seder. We sit down at the Seder, and we're about to reenact this whole experience of redemption. But where are we doing this from? From what disposition are we actually undergoing this entire reenactment? We are doing so from the context of Golos itself, from the context of exile. So what is the point, asks the Tzof Amarim, what is the point of actually sitting down at the Seder and going through this whole process of what it was like for them to be enslaved and for them to leave and achieve Geula, when at the end of the day, we are not in an experience of Geula. So that Hodah, it's sort of like we're being thankful for something they experienced back then that we are not necessarily the benefits of. So the Haggadah says, if we wouldn't have been redeemed, we would still be under the dominion, maybe the physical dominion, maybe the spiritual dominion of Mitzrayim. But at the end of the day, it's one thing to be thankful, and it's one thing to experience Chayav Adam Liras Atzmo Geula Yotzam Mitzrayim Bizman HaGeula, at the time that there's a Beis HaMikdash. So you're sitting with a Beis HaMikdash, and you're saying to yourself, even though I'm sitting in a Beis HaMikdash, and I'm eating the Korban Pesach, don't forget the legacy and the story of the Jewish people. Don't forget, Avadim Hayinu Lufaro B'Mitzrayim, and Hashem took us out, and everything we have today is because of that moment. But now we're saying this from the context of exile itself. So what is the... So that's a questionable mindset. What does that mean? That we're trying to recreate this whole experience of redemption. We're not in redemption. So V'yesh Lomar, he says the following. To be Mitzrayim lahoya b'yadeinu lekarev gu'ulaseinu. He says such, something very beautiful. You should know that when we were in Mitzrayim, so we know, right, that in Mitzrayim, the Jewish people were essentially living out a narrative that was already prescribed generations earlier. Hashem comes to Avram Avinu and he says, the Jewish people are going to, part of the Bris Ben Abisarim is, the Jewish people are going to be enslaved, the Jewish people are going to be redeemed. So if you are a teenager growing up in Egyptian servitude, it's you're living the story, the narrative of the Jewish people that's been determined. You are living a determined reality. It's not an outcome of your own choice. It's not that you did something to effectuate this reality. And you're not going to be able in Mitzrayim to draw the Geula closer at all. Bishum ofen mizman shayah katzel v'Avram Avinu. From the time that Avram Avinu was told, this galus will end. So it happens to be that in the end, out of Rachmanis, because the Jewish people cry out to Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu dilei gal haketz, he skips and he brings it a little sooner, but he does so either through calculating the years of galus from the birth of Yitzchak, or he does so through taking into account not only the quantity of servitude, but the quality of servitude, exactly what they were experiencing. Koshe Ashibud Masha Enkein, says the Tzof Amarim, but that is in contrast, Begolus Hazeh, to the galus that we are experiencing. She'ein lo zman katsuv, rak hayom im bikolo tishmo'u. That yes, we are living in a time of galus. However, our galus is very different than their galus. Their galus had a prescribed period of time that had to be. And so therefore, no matter what they did, they were not going to accelerate beyond what HaKadosh Baruch Hu, out of his compassion, contracted the Gezerah to a shorter amount of years. But there's a minimal period of time that this was definitely going to be a galus. We live in a galus, and it may have lasted for a very long time up until now, but the reality is that it is within our capacity to advance ourselves beyond this galus and to achieve the experience of Geula. Ve'ein ha'davar taloi ela banu. The galus today, the difference between galus Mitzrayim and galus today, is galus Mitzrayim was because Hashem ordained that that's what they're going to be. That's part of the development of the Jewish people. We can talk about that another time. Necessitated this crucible of Shibud Mitzrayim. But in today's day and age, we don't need this. We don't have to have this. This is entirely a product of our compromising values and behavior 2,000 years ago, the times of the second Beis HaMikdash. And its endurance is entirely an outcome of our own inability to calibrate our priorities and our values and focus ourselves appropriately. So we have no, we are not, this is not preordained. This is happening because we choose to continue to let this happen. We choose to continue to comport ourselves in such a way that the galus endures. V'yesh kama mitzvos kalos ma'od shemekarvin es ha-geula. So he writes, you should know, there are certain mitzvos that do accelerate geula. Not all mitzvos are created equal. We're not told that if you're really makpid on tzitzis, geula will come. If you're really makpid on shiluach hakan, geula will come. That's not what we're told. Shamru chazal gedolat tzedakah shemekareves es hageula. One of the things we are told is that tzedakah, extending ourselves, whether with resources or with our home or with our life in general, that is mekareves es hageula. So that's what he says. That's how he interprets this opening paragraph. So listen to this. We're sitting here now in Passaic, New Jersey, or wherever you're going to be eating your matzah, Be'ezus Hashem, very soon. So we're sitting. So they sat Be'ara de Mitzrayim. They ate this poor man's bread in Mitzrayim. Shezos ha-matzah himamish ka'oso lechem. So this halach ma'anya, that matzah that's on the table, that bread of affliction, it's the same bread of affliction they had in Mitzrayim. Sharei gam ato anachnu begola. And we, let's remember when they had the matzah. They had the matzah before they left Mitzrayim. With the Korban Pesach, they had the matzah. So we are going to eat matzah tonight, just like they ate matzah in Mitzrayim when they were in Golus. They were in Golus, we're in Golus. Ela shebechozos ata biyodenu lekarav gulasein. You know the difference between them and us? They ate matzah all those years of Shibud Mitzrayim because they had no choice. We have a choice. What could we do? Kol dichvin yesei veyechol uveschus zeh. If we open our homes, if we open our lives, v'schus zeh hashtahacha l'shana habar be'arad Yisrael. And that's the connection between the two. That's why if we are prepared to open our homes, to open our lives, to welcome other people, to extend ourselves to others, then we may right now be where they were in Mitzrayim, looking at the matzah in the zone of Shibud, but we could ultimately achieve, we could push on the momentum of Jewish history, and we could move ourselves towards the experience of Geula. And that's why we open the Seder with this very peculiar call to having other people join us. Why are we having other people join us? And it's more than that. It's not just the notion that we want to give tzedakah. It's specifically in the context, not just like helping people out by giving them Seder stuff. It's having them join our Seder. It's opening our homes. It's opening our lives. We'll talk about this a little bit on Shabbos, but Rav Soloveitchik, in one of his svarim about Avram Avinu, talks about, we discussed this before, the mitzvah of achnasas orchim is not just the mitzvah of giving people a meal. That's not achnasas orchim. Achnasas orchim is to invite someone into your home. So the Rav distinguishes three ways that achnasas orchim is more significant than your average chesed. But we could add a fourth. And the fourth is that what it does is it creates common ground. It creates an opportunity for Klal Yisrael to reconstruct the unraveling of unity that is ultimately responsible for the galus that we are experiencing now. Hachnasas Orchim, which the Ramah writes, does not refer to inviting your friends. If you invite people you like, then you're a wonderful person and you're socially active and God bless you. But that is not the mitzvah of Hachnasas Orchim. I always hate saying this halakha over, because then the next time I invite someone, I feel like they're looking at me funny, right? But the real mitzvah of Achnasas Orchim is to invite people you would not otherwise invite. People of a different social tone. People of a different hashkafa. People of a different economic position. People of a different stage in life. People that you would not otherwise be opening your home and your life and making yourself vulnerable to and all of this kind of thing, and to bring them together. So Achnasas Orchim, that's the pshat. That's why... Why are we using Achnasas Orchim specifically right now at the outset of the Seder? Because we're trying to bring the Jewish people together so that we could ultimately move ourselves further in the experience of the Jewish people. We then move into the Manish Tana. And the Manish Tana, of course, articulates a number of different questions that are asked. So the Aruch HaShulchan, in his Sefer Leil Shimurim, the Aruch HaShulchan writes that he raises a question that everybody, many, many people raise. We know there are four things that we ask about. One of the things we don't ask about, Rabbi Fink, just give me a really dirty look if I hit something that you're going to be talking about. Usually I have someone here that gives me dirty looks, but they happen not to be here this evening, so I'm already at a deficit, so it's all good. It's all good. It'll keep everything at equilibrium. So the Manish Tana asks about all sorts of differentiating elements of the Seder. So we have chametz u'matzah normally, kulo matzah, we have maror, we dip twice, we lean, why are we leaning, right? By the way, in the Rav's Haggadah, he talks about the fact that this really resonated with me. The Rav said that when we talk about the mitzvah to lean, we don't mean to like lean, like slant your body suspended in midair. The Rav said that the leaning was leaning against something. It was comfortable. It was wonderful. It was more of a lazy boy situation. That's what it means to lean. But to just awkwardly kind of like bend your body to the side and start drinking, I wouldn't say that that describes a free person. I would say that describes a slightly off person, right? Like why are you eating like this? So, I feel bad. You brought it for yourself.
No, I didn't.
You are? Oh, Kirkland. You have to buy it before Pesach. That's the OU's maskana. So, the Rav says, don't just like lean uncomfortably, like lean on something. And even in the Rav's Haggadah, he even says, you know, one of the options could be to kind of move the chair so you could lean into the chair. Obviously, if there's a pillow, but I'm sure you all have this experience where between the fact that it's a chair not really designed to lean and the chair doesn't really have enough room for this pillow, it's one of the more uncomfortably sitting evenings, you know, for many. But anyway, so one of the things that the Manish Tana does not discuss that is a little bit of an aberration, hopefully in most homes, is the Arba Kosos, right? Why are you drinking four cups of wine as part of the dinner experience? I don't know if anybody here has ever been to the Oxnard restaurant in California. Anybody been? Gula for sure, right? So you know where I'm going with this. So there's no Manish Tana on the Dalad Kaisis over there. You get a course, you get a wine, you get a course, you get a wine, you get a course, you get a wine, and then you get in Uber. So we went there on some anniversary, but I can't remember anything that happened. So says the Leil Shimurim, says the Aruch HaShulchan, Lahavin lama lo nizkar b'sheilas arba kosos. Why don't we ask about arba kosos? So he answers, interestingly, V'nira delefi shedavar ze yadua l'chom min ha'enoshi shal kol inyin Yeshua o simcha shosin yayin v'lo etzleinu bilvad. So he says something very important He answers this question, but through his answer, we hit an important theme in the Seder. And that is that why is it not strange to drink? Because we're celebrating something. And alcohol, in most places, is associated with celebrating something, right? It's normal. It's normal at a wedding to have some wine. It's normal. These things are all normal. So if we're celebrating Geula, if we're celebrating redemption, it is normal that as part of that, maybe not top four, but as part of that, maybe top a Rov Kos and be measuring Revius's, but as part of that, to have some wine, that is considered normal. So says the Aruch HaShulchan, so then what really is the Chiddush of the Arba Kosos? What is the Arba Kosos coming to really contribute? In what way are they a mitzvah? So why not just allow this to be a natural, the same way you do on Purim. Chayim Inish, to integrate wine into the celebration of the Suda. So tell everyone, Chayim Inish, to integrate a little bit of wine into the celebration of the Geula. Why do you have to be so formal with it? So he writes, because there's a very important Yesod, and he quotes a Pasuk. Kos Yeshuos Esa, Shem Hashem Ekra. Right? And we lift up the cup, Kos Yeshuos Esa, we lift the cup of salvation, V'Shem Hashem Ekra. But the Dalet Kosos, the reason why they're unique on Pesach, is because it's not just an expression of our own sense of elation and celebratory, expression on Pesach. That the Dalet Kosos are about us recognizing Hotseisi Hitzalti Ga'alti Lakachti, that this experience of redemption was entirely driven by the Rabbonu Shel Olam himself. That even though normally when we look at an unfolding experience of salvation, we can attribute all of the different salvatory elements to various human initiative, right? We could say Mordechai did this and Esther did this. And we could say, in the Six-Day War, this soldier did this and that commander did this. In the 48 War, this one did this. In the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, this one did this. Even though normally we can connect a sense of moving forward with the initiative of a human being. Yetzias Mitzrayim is the paradigm of recognition. Lo yidei malach, v'lo yidei saraf, v'lo yidei shliach. This is not through human intervention. This was an entirely divinely orchestrated and implemented redemption of the Jewish people. And that is intended to embolden us with the recognition that Geula, as we relate to it, is not just being rescued or being saved. The process of redemption is when the Ribbono Shel Olam enters the picture and begins to rearrange and reorchestrate all of the factors of the world realities in service of this ultimate goal of redeeming the Jewish people. So it doesn't matter how things look. So we look at the world today and we see incredible rise in anti-Semitism. Incredible. The numbers are off the charts. And we see very unsettled realities in Eretz Yisrael. And we see all sorts of challenges of attrition within our own community. And we see all sorts of challenges with family in our own community. We see all these different economic challenges, except now in Florida, where everyone could go to school for free. Right? We see all sorts of different issues. And we say to ourselves, these are the antecedents of potential redemption. This is an environment within which redemption could take place. No way in a million years can that possibly happen. That is because our calculus is entirely anchored to the human capacity to arrange these realities in such a way that there's a pathway towards redemption. But once we recognize that ultimately Geula comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that is part of Seder night. Part of Seder night is Kos Yeshuas Esa V'Shem Hashem Ekra. The notion that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one who is ultimately responsible for everything that is taking place, for everything that we are doing. To share another thought towards, I guess a little bit more towards the beginning. Baruch Hu Shakadosh Baruch Hu Chishev Es Akeid Slasos Kemoshe Amar. So, the Haggadah talks about Hashem being loyal to His promise to the Jewish people to ultimately redeem Am Yisrael. So we discussed that there was a 190-year reprieve in terms of the years that we were given, that we were supposed to be in Galus Mitzrayim. So the question is, how do we resolve the original decree that the Ribbono Shel Olam himself gave and the actual Yetzias Mitzrayim, which ended up happening earlier? So one of the answers to this is that the count, the originating count, was changed. That originally, in Kadosh Baruch Hu, everyone would think we count from the times that the Jewish people descended to Mitzrayim. That's when the Shibud began. Vayakam Melech Chadash, Hashem Lo Yada Es Yosef, and that's when the Shibud begins. And then all of a sudden, everybody begins to work it out. But the other possibility, the Medrash says, is that we begin the count earlier. When do we begin the count? Medrash makes a very funny suggestion, and that is we begin the count from the period of time of Yitzchak. From the period of time of Yitzchak. So basically, as soon as the Ribbono Shel Olam reveals to the Jewish people that this is going to be part of the reality of the unfolding and development of Am Yisrael, so the Avos already were beginning to experience a dissonance between the stability that one would expect in being loyal to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and to all his expectations and to everything he wants from you, and much of the challenges that were experienced by the individual Avos in their various journeys throughout the unfolding Parashios of Sefer Bereishis. So in this Sof HaMarim, so he explains that the reason why this was chosen, the reason why the Avos are evoked here, is because Sha'af al Pisha Avos Ahayalahem Golos Rak Shahayalahem Tsar B'machshava Me'agolios Nechshav LiYisrael Ki'ilu Oyo B'Golos. So he says, it wasn't that the Avos themselves experienced Galus, it's that since they knew, since they had an awareness that this was going to happen to the Jewish people ultimately, that knowledge, that foreknowledge, that this is what was going to be, that in and of itself was an oppressive and compromising experience, and we could begin Galus from there. So, like, God forbid, someone's in a situation where they know that that their child or their descendants are going to experience something that is very, very challenging and very, very difficult. Even if it's not yet unfolding, even if it's not actually happening, just living with that knowledge, just living with that reality, is in and of itself a form of exile and pain and consternation. And so therefore, since they had to live with that reality itself, that knowledge on behalf of the Avos, that itself was a form of the beginning of Galus, so we could begin the count, we could begin the count from there. And that also is what relates to the larger notion of Pesach, the connection between generations. I'll share one other idea, then we'll turn it over. So we know that over the course of the various makos, the makah that ultimately takes us out of Mitzrayim and actually gives rise to the name Pesach is, of course, which one? Makas Bechoros. Makas Bechoros. The killing of the firstborn. So in Rav Soloveitchik's Haggadah, he says the following: Yesh la'ayin ma motza HaKadosh Baruch Hu yifora davka min HaBechoros. Why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu pick on the firstborns of the Mitzrayim? Throughout the story of Mitzrayim, we don't hear anything about special status of these Bechorim in the context of the narrative itself. They're being oppressed by the taskmasters, by everybody in Mitzrayim, by Paro himself, by his assistants, by his Chartumim. Where did the Bechorim come in all of a sudden? So he says, V'nira d'hinei b'nei Yisrael, sh'nishtabu b'mitzrayim l'nishtabu l'paro b'lvar, l'nishtabu l'chol ha'uma ha'mitzris. The Shibud Mitzrayim was not just a servitude to this, you know, power-hungry maniac king, Paro himself, but rather the servitude was to the nation itself, right? There's a difference between having a monarch who's, you know, enacting all sorts of edicts and anti-Semitic laws that you're the subject to, right? Jewish people have had both of these experiences, and living in a society where it's not just the monarch, he may be setting the tone, but the actual constituents, the actual citizens of the society itself are holding the Jewish people in a way that's oppressive. So in Mitzrayim, we were mishtabed to the nation itself. The after Paro haya hamelech v'tzibur v'kudas on mishtabdu, but k'day l'shabed u'mashlema, ainz v'yichol t'shal melech echad. This can't happen just with one melech, but rather it needs the nation as a whole. How do you have the nation as a whole? So he writes, the way they have a nation as a whole, she'yishabdu b'nei Yisrael. How is that possible? So the Rav explains, it's possible through the most powerful representative in each of these homes. And in Egyptian culture, explains the Rav, the firstborn, the racious ono, the one who exerted dominance in the home, and we know those that are firstborns or those that are victims of firstborns in their birth order are aware that there is a certain natural disposition of dominance that emerges, even if it's not intentional, you know, in the part of the firstborn for all of the reasons that we know. So in Mitzrayim, that was exacerbated and exaggerated, and to the extent that it was the firstborn in each home that set the tone of anti-Semitic culture and the oppressive attitudes and dispositions towards Am Yisrael. So when it came time for Makas Bechoros, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu exacts his din upon these individuals. But something else happens at the same time. Because as HaKadosh Baruch Hu redeems Am Yisrael from Mitzrayim, this notion, this hashkafa of the Bechor, he didn't want that the Jewish people should just walk away from the situation saying, oh, that's what a Bechor is. Bechor is dominance and power, and Hashem is responding to that dominance and power. No, he wanted the Jewish people to walk away understanding what is dominance and power in the context of familial life from a Torah perspective. And the answer is dominance and power. You know what the firstborn is good for? The firstborn is good not for power, but for service. And so therefore, it's on Seder night that all of the Bechorim are consecrated to be the ones to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. They're the ones that are ultimately going to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. And the Beis HaMikdash was very different, this vision. With apologies to the Kohanim, it wasn't that there's an elite class of Kohanim. It's that every family had a representative in that Beis HaMikdash. Every family's greatest strength and most dominant person was not somebody who was exerting power and pulling his sister's hair and giving his little brothers a hard time, but rather, he was the one that went off to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. He had to have a certain religious stature, a certain spiritual commitment, a certain orientation of growth in order to be able to do such a thing. So there was the whole transition of how to look at the power structure of a family and of a community. That's part of what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was creating on Seder night itself. Now, relates to what we talked about at Shalosh Shudis that like two of you were at this past Shabbos, where we spoke about the Karban Pesach as being the foundation of the creation of the nation because it coalesced the people around their individual families. And that the family is the foundation of the nation, and the nation ultimately is what's given this mandate to impact the larger world. I want to wish everyone an amazing Pesach. And turn it over to Rabbi Fink to share with us some ideas. This will be great because now finally I'll have something to say at the Seder, and that's all worth it to me. Okay.
Okay, good evening, everyone. It's really an incredible honor and a privilege to be here. Brachos Rabbi Glasser, and Brachos my father as well, who actually is often a Dvar Torah and Drasha Charus of mine. So it's a big schus to be speaking in his presence. And if you like Dvar Torah I share, it's likely has to do with him. So that's a big opportunity to give a public Hakar Satov. So again, it's a real pleasure to be here, a pleasure to be part of the community for this year. Here is the Wexner Kol Elyon intern. And throughout the year, I really felt like I've become a real part of the community. But perhaps tonight, the opportunity to prepare for Pesach together has given me an additional welcome and place that I feel really part of the community, perhaps more than anything. My wife sent me to aisle one on the way. And everyone here is familiar, but just the experience of going from Shibud to Geula, from Afela to Or Gadol here in Passaic, New Jersey was an incredible experience. And then searching through the back of the store, the freezer section, for some obscure item that my wife sent me a screenshot of. Luckily, someone was there, and I was able to find the item, and I will be welcome home tonight. Once again, a pleasure to share Dibrei Torah, as well, I guess, now give Rabbi Glasser an opportunity to respond to all of our frantic WhatsApps, but his phone is right here, so, okay. I want to begin with a thought on Shulchan Aruch, so a little bit jumping to the middle of the Leil HaSeder, but I want to open it up with an anecdote that takes us back about 100 years. So we're doing a lot of history recently, so we're going to continue with the history theme. It's about Sugihara. Sugihara, who was the first Japanese imperial consul posted in Lithuania in the 1930s and the 1940s. And Sugihara is famous for issuing visas that saved thousands of Jews from the Holocaust during World War II. In his memoirs, he recalls his first encounter with the Jewish people. And he writes that he was shocked by two things. He was shocked by how much the Jewish people argued and by how much we ate. And the gathering that Sugihara was exposed to was, in fact, a family Hanukkah party. There's a whole story of how he got to that Hanukkah party, but clearly he must have walked in and been incredibly impressed by Lithuanian latke consumption and a heated argument that must have been triggered by an intense dreidel competition. But can you try to imagine what Sugihara must have felt if he had walked into a Pesach Seder, an entire evening dedicated to dining and dialogue, an evening where Jews around the world sit together to talk about food, how much matzah you're supposed to eat, how you're supposed to lean, as Rabbi Glasser mentioned, where everyone's supposed to sit, trying to figure out all the seating arrangements and who's leaning on whose shoulders, and, you know, did you make Aunt Ruthie's harosis recipe? We always like that one. And additionally, every detail of the Seder night is subject to generations of rabbinic debate. The nature of the four cups of wine, the timing of the afikomen, even what words we're actually supposed to say and when, are all subject to generations of dialogue that in many ways continues until today. Additionally, when one looks at the structure of the Seder itself, one is struck at the centrality of Shulchan Aruch, the festive meal. Shulchan Aruch is couched by two cups of wine, two before and two after. Matzah before and afikomen, matzah after. Even halal, normally we don't divide up halal, but at the Seder night, half of it is recited before the meal in the middle, and half of it recited afterwards. It seems almost that the festive meal becomes the focus and epicenter of the evening's experience. So let's try to understand. What is the nature of all of the Jewish dining and dialogue that is so central to the Seder and the general culture of Judaism? There's a tradition from the Zohar, and many Sfarim bring down, that if one looks at the etymology of the words lechem and matzah, both of them actually relate to the words about battle or conflict. Lechem is from the word milchama, to fight, conflict, battle. And similarly, matzah refers to the word mitzah, as well, a conflict, some struggle that is occurring. Chazal even say that when one sits down to their meal, they call it a shas milchama, a time of battle. And all of this is incredibly strange. So my Rebbe, and someone I have this chus to be a chavrusa with this year as well, is Rabbi Chaim Packer from the Lower East Side. So he explained that the core of eating and battle in many ways are one and the same. Doesn't really help. But one goes to battle, at its core, what one is trying to accomplish is to incorporate foreign entities into oneself. Entities such as land, people, and property. The goal of that battle is really to incorporate them into my own country, nationhood, people, property, to incorporate them into myself. And likewise, when one eats, one is incorporating an external source of nutrition into oneself. As the saying goes, you are what you eat. But I would like to suggest it's not only the food that we incorporate into our being, but it's also the people, ideas and connections to those we eat with that are being incorporated into our being as well. Leon Cass is the author of a book titled The Hungry Soul. And he writes, and I quote, "The openness and responsiveness of the diners is on occasion not unrelated to the meal. Stimulation of the palate stimulates the mind. Conversation at dinner, though not about the food, can often be inspired by the food. Good talk and good food go naturally together." Additionally, Bruce Feiler, another author who has published extensively on happy families, reflects in his book, The Secret of Happy Families, on a study that was conducted by the University of Michigan that examined how American children spent their time between 1981 and 1997. They discovered that the amount of time children spent eating meals at home was the single biggest predictor of better academic achievement and fewer behavioral problems. Mealtime was found to be more influential than time spent in school, studying, attending religious services, or playing sports. Leon Cass and Bruce Feiler, who we just quoted, are expressing what we have been practicing at the Seder for generations. The fulcrum of the Seder becomes Shulchan Orech, and it's a time of intellectual conflict and battle. Conflict and battle in the sense that it's a time we incorporate not only the delicious food, but the memories, stories, and, we're from YU, intergenerational dialogue that it generates. The memory of Bubby's recipes that evoke the majestic imagery of Zadie sitting at the Seder like a king are present at the Seder by design. So allow us to enter together into this evening of dining and dialogue with the prayer we recite in benching on Seder night, that it should be a yom shetzadikim yoshvin, a night where the righteous sit together, v'nenim, and they benefit and imbibe miziv hashchina, from the divine presence. Yehi chalkenu imahem. May our portion be amongst them. So with that, let's move to back to the beginning of the Haggadah and share another thought on Avadim Hayinu. Avadim Hayinu comes right after Manishtana, the four questions that are asked. And the Mishnah Berurah brings down that it is very important to make sure that the kids do not yet go to sleep. That we kept them up for Manishtana, we're so excited to see how the two-year-old's going to get up and not say a word after singing for months. Manishtana, for months, nothing. But we're excited, we keep them up. And then after that, often, okay, so now it's time to go to sleep. Let's get the house a little bit quieter and let's move on with the rest of the evening. But says the Mishnah Berurah, make sure you keep them around at least for Avadim Hayinu. Because, he says, that's the answer to the questions. Ma nishtana halayla hazeh? And we answer that question by going through Avadim Hayinu. This never occurred to me until I saw it this year in a brand new Haggadah that just came out just less than a month ago. So this is hot off the press. This is Mishulchan Rabbeinu Eliyahu Baruch Finkel. Rabbeinu Eliyahu Finkel was a Maggid Shir for many, many years at the Mir Yeshiva in Yerushalayim. He's, I believe, a cousin of Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel, the previous Rosh Yeshiva. The Talmidim just put out this Haggadah. And my brother Shlomo, who just came back for Ben Azmanim from Tomo, was very, very kind and bought a copy for me. It's very, very nice of him. So I was going through some of the pieces. And he is the one that points out that Avadim Hayinu brings down this Mishnah Berurah and points out that Avadim Hayinu is supposed to be the answer. And of course, the question is, how is Avadim Hayinu the answer to these four questions? Why is this night different? Why every night we eat chametz? Now we eat matzah. Tonight we're leaning. We don't usually lean. We dip twice. We eat marr. All these questions. We're in Avadim Hayinu, certainly on the surface, we don't address any of those questions. So where is it in Avadim Hayinu that we're answering the questions of Manishtana? So he brings down two approaches. The first one is perhaps a little more technical, but showing how each line within Avadim Hayinu responds to one of the specific questions. So the first approach, he says, the first question, Manishtana, halayla zakulo matzah, that tonight, why are we only eating matzah? So he says, when you look in Avadim Hayinu, what's one of the lines? Vayotzienu, Hashem Elokeinu Misham, that Hashem took us out from Mitzrayim with his strong hand. part of the Hashem's strong hand was we didn't have time for the dough to rise. So the dough didn't rise. That's why we're eating matzah. Answer to question number one, matzah versus chametz. Number two, maror, why not every other night? We eat other vegetables, tonight we're eating maror. So that's the first line, the first two words, avad demayinu. We were slaves. They embittered our lives. We eat bitter herbs. That's the second approach. The third, the third answer, what about mesubim? So that's what we say in the paragraph of Adamayinu. V'ilu lahotzi HaKadosh Baruch Hu es avoseinu, harei anu uvenei vaneinu, mishubadim ayinu lefarabim Mitzrayim. That if Hashem did not take us out, so we would still be enslaved to Paro and Mitzrayim. So to demonstrate the fact that that's not true, and we Hashem did redeem us, and we are free, that's why tonight we have to lean. Number four, so I successfully turned my page. So why do we dip twice? So for that, he says, the line in Avadim Ayinu that we say is that Afilu kulanu chachamim, kulanu nevonim, kulanu yodim es haTorah, mitzvah aleinu lesaper b'yitzis Mitzrayim. And even if we are wise, even if we know the story, even if this is our 50th time going through the story, mitzvah aleinu lesaper, it's a mitzvah for us to tell it over again. The chol hamarbe, anyone who increases their involvement within this mitzvah, harei zeh meshubach, that's a praiseworthy thing. So, but what? How do we increase the story? How do we tell more? So we do different things. One of the things we do differently is we dip twice, and we do strange things, and we take away the Seder plate, and we do other creative, strange things at the Seder to try to engage people and pique curiosity and be able to engage everyone in a conversation that is fit for everyone that's there. So that's the first technical way of just going through Avadim Ayinu line by line. And again, this is a way I never thought of. I thought, okay, Avadim Ayinu, it's very nice. But it's right after Manashtana. And when you think about it, you could see it's a little bit beneath the surface, maybe intentionally, because you have to scratch at the surface and be able to think, wait, what's this doing here? Why are we saying this now? What does each line mean? And then through the conversation at the table, we could engender and engage people in figuring out what the answer to these questions must be. And we see how again, Rav Eliel Baruch Finkel brought out on a technical level how that's all true. He has a second approach that I want to share as well. That second approach is a little bit broader. And he says that Manishtana Halayla Hazeh is actually a much broader question about the nature of the entire evening, which expresses itself in four ways, but those four ways are really just details of the difference of Manishtana Halayla Hazeh Mikol Halaylos. And he says, because every other yantif, and think about it for a second, how do we commemorate a yontif in general? Is we zone in on the primary characteristic and takeaway from that yontif, from the miracle or from the outcome of that day. And then we capture that. So just recently we had Purim. So Purim was a day where we were saved. We had a physical salvation. We celebrate it in a physical way. Mishloach Manos, and we have a Suda, and we have all these things that celebrate the physical salvation of an Ace of Purim. That's the primary characteristic of the day, commemorated in that way. On the flip side, Sukkot is also a day of simcha, it's a day of happiness. We do different things to increase happiness and to share our joy with others and so on. On the flip side, Tisha B'Av, a day of destruction, a day of suffering, and again, we'll flip it. Now, if I start giving your Shabbos Haggadol drasha, so you'll give me the dirty look, but a day of, Rabbi Glasser said something, drasha was about something about suffering, and I said one of the things I wanted to share was about suffering. So I'm not going to talk. This will be the last mention about suffering, and all of you will have to suffer through that this Shabbos. But the idea that we were saying, once I remember it, exactly, that Tisha B'Av, which is a day of suffering, so then it's commemorated by Avelus. It's commemorated by putting ourselves in a state of mourning. Basically, the point that we're getting at is that every other yontif, we take the primary characteristic of that day, and we capture it in our commemoration. What about Pesach? What about the Seder? What's going on? So many contradictory themes are going on and are being expressed and are being acted out all in one. The Maror, which is Vayimaras Chayayim, we're commemorating the Shibud, we're commemorating the bitterness. But on the other hand, we're leaning. We have dalakosos. This is, we're free. We're enjoying ourselves. We're having a good time. We're having a nice meal. Matzah, which is both a commemoration of the cheras that, as we mentioned, HaKadosh Baruch Hu took us out quickly, commemoration of the Cheiros, but it's also a commemoration of the Shibud, the Matzah Asher Achla Vasana Be'arad Mitzrayim. This was the bread of affliction. So we have all these contradictory themes that are all coming together that are confusing Maskel B'Gnos Messiah B'Shavach. We start with the bad, we end with the good, and we go through this whole process of acting out what Yetzias Mitzrayim was, and we live it once again. So that's the question. Manishtana halayla azami kol halilos. How is this, why is this night different than taking the primary theme, the primary element of the Yontif, and then capturing that in some form of a commemoration? But we relive the entire thing. And that's exactly the answer. Is that avadim hayinu v'lo es avoseinu bilvad. That we were slaves, but lo es avoseinu. This is not only a historical event that happened thousands of years ago, but it's going to happen again tonight. That whatever Shibud was experienced in Mitzrayim, there are elements on a personal, individual level, communal level, that are experienced b'chol dor v'dor. And the night of Yetzias Mitzrayim is a night where we relive every element of that experience of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Both the Shibud, both the Geula, and even the contradictory themes within Matzah, where we experience both at the same moment. And that's how Manashtana leads into Avadim Hayinu. That it's a broader question. This night is totally different than everything we're used to. And Avadim Hayinu is the answer. That tonight, we're not just commemorating one primary characteristic of the takeaway of the Yontif, but we're reliving it. Because everything that happened then is happening again tonight. So we mentioned Maskel B'Gnos and Messiah B'Shavach. We mentioned the idea that one is meant to start B'Gnos and Messiah B'Shavach, that we start with the negative aspects and elements of the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Different opinions in the Gemara of where that's actually supposed to start. Does that start Avadim Hayinu? Does that start Mitzchila of the Avodah Zarah Hayo Avoseinu? Different Mepharshim explained maybe one has more to do with the ideological Shibud, the Avodah Zarah, that we became subject to foreign ideologies, and the other one is maybe more Avodah Mayino, more of it is the physical bondage that we were a part of. So different opinions, but either way, there's Maskel B'Gnos and Messiah B'Shavach, that we're supposed to have both the negative elements and the positive elements of the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim as we tell the story on the night of the Seder. So there's a beautiful word from the Sfas Emes. We mentioned Purim a few minutes ago, so we'll go back to Purim as well to take on an idea for the Seder, which is that the Seder itself is called exactly that. It's called the Seder. It's called an order. There's a very specific order through which we are supposed to unfold the story, how you're supposed to tell it, how you're what you're supposed to do. Here you stand, here you say this, here you lift up the cup, you cover the matzahs. There's a Seder. There's an order and a process through which we are supposed to go on as we experience the Seder. There's a halacha when it comes to reading Megillah Esther, that hakori lamafreya lo yatza, that if one reads the Megillah out of order, so lo yatza, you're not yotza, you don't fulfill the obligation. So Sfas Emes shares a beautiful idea. He says, why not? So he says that if I jump to the end of the Megillah, which is a story, again, there it's a story of Hester, it's a story where everything is hidden, and I just jump to the point where I'm able to see the salvation, so that I miss the point. Hakoyel Mafreya, if I go out of order and I skip to the end of the book, and I just see that we lived happily ever after, so I miss the point. Because part of the point is to go through every step of the process. The genos, the shevach, the ups and the downs that we experience in our national history and in our personal lives, we don't just jump to the end, but we live through every moment. And in every moment, we realize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was holding our hands, sometimes openly, but sometimes only behind the scenes. So that's the idea, perhaps in the Seder as well. Maskel B'Gnos and Messiah B'Shavach, and we go through this specific order. Why do we do that? Because part of creating that experience is to realize we can't just jump to the end. We can't just focus on the good. Because the entire experience, the entire process, was all part of that broader connection, relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he tried to build with us both as a nation and as individuals, was through holding us through both the times that were difficult and challenging and also through the times that were obvious that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had saved us. There's a lot of fascinating little snippets to add into this. There was an article published in the New York Times, I think back in 2013, by the same author, Bruce Feiler, the author I mentioned a few ideas ago, who did a lot of studies about happy families. So he published an article in the New York Times 2013 on resilience in families. And he refers to research that was done by someone named Dr. Duke, who's a psychologist that does a lot of research on what creates a strong and healthy families. And he discovered that knowing a family narrative that includes both ups and downs within one's family is a high predictor of resilience within children, adolescents, up to adults. And he found that these narratives that families could give over to their children take one of three forms. The first is the ascending family narrative. Something that goes something like this. Son, when we came to the country, we had nothing. Our family worked, we opened a store, your grandfather went to high school, your father went to college, and now you. So that's the ascending story. Look where we started, and now look where we are today. And the second would be the descending narrative. That, sweetheart, we used to have it all, but then we lost everything. This descending. We started up here, and now we're down here. But the most hurtful narrative, Dr. Duke continued, is the third one. And it's called the oscillating family narrative. It goes something like this. Dear, let me tell you. We've had ups and downs in our family. We built a family business. Your grandfather was a pillar of the community. Your mother was on the board of the hospital. But we also had setbacks. You had an uncle who was once arrested. You had a house burned down. Your father lost a job. But no matter what happened, we always stuck together as a family. That third family narrative, Maschil Beganosa Messiah B'Shavach, is exactly what we're doing on the night of the Seder. On the night of the Seder, we tell the national story of the Jewish people. Just earlier today, Rosweig quoted from the Rav, he said the zigzag theory of Jewish history was the phrase that the Rav used to describe Jewish history. That while for the nations of the world, history generally takes a linear path, where a nation will rise, will reach its climax, and then ultimately fall. It's a linear path. The Jewish people zigzag in and out, up and down. And that's the story we go into the night of the Seder. This Maschil B'Gnosu Messiahim B'Shavach is what creates that strong family narrative. What's absolutely fascinating as part of this research, just an interesting anecdote about it, was that they were studying families, this about in the year 2000, that they were studying children and trying to find predictors of what predicted family resilience. And as they're doing the research, they already collected a significant amount of data. And this study continued into September of 2001. Of course, 9/11 was a catastrophe that struck the entire nation. And while obviously not planned by these psychologists, they now had an additional measure of how to gauge which children would be most resilient to this national trauma that the entire nation was reeling from. And once again, the children that were exposed to a stronger family narrative, of that oscillating family narrative that has highs and lows and is able to expose children to both parts, not just the highs, not just the positives, not in just only a purely ascending narrative, not only a descending narrative, but one that includes both, those children were found to be the most resilient. Thank you once again for joining us tonight. Thank you for Shoshra Rabbi Glasser, a very big schluss to share the Torah together and prepare for this wonderful, incredible, amazing night of Leil HaSeder. Wishing everyone a Chag Kasher Sameach, a wonderful Yantif.